comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Today, we've already sent out the K-Files, so if you have been putting it off and you haven't subscribed, well, you missed this week's edition. And I'm very sorry you did, but you can correct that for next week by simply going to the website and look where it says K-Files and click it. In about 20 seconds or less, you're subscribed. 5 seconds or less, you're subscribed. You'll get an email with a confirmation link or an activation link for you to click, activate your subscription, and you're good to go. And it's free, absolutely free. Let me encourage you also, if you have not yet joined our members area, let me encourage you to do that. You know, you're missing out on a real community of activity and a world of information by not being a member. It costs 23 cents a day. Now, for most of us, 23 cents a day is not devastating. I do understand there are situations where it just is out of the question, but those are not the majority. The majority could cut back one cigarette a day. You could cut back one cup of coffee a day. And in fact, in both of those cases, have money left over. For 23 cents a day, you can be a member of our members area, and then you get to watch the show. You get to, if you miss the live show, you can watch it anyway because we upload the video of it. You get all the archives, you get the forums, you get your own profile page, your own blog, your own photo gallery page, and so forth. You got lots of stuff in there for 23 cents. It's absolutely the best value on the internet, so be sure you join up today. Now, I suppose that everyone on Earth is keenly aware of all of the momentous events in Egypt. One group of people out there have to be even more aware, I'm sure, and that would be the global elite. Because as they watched this popular uprising against the ruling elite in Egypt, I'm betting they have their panties in a knot. Why? Because they're seeing living proof of what you've heard me say right here on the show many, many times, and that is that when the people in any country have had enough of the government's boot on their throats, they will take down their oppressors. It's interesting, though, that the statements coming out of Washington, D.C., are calling on the Egyptian government to stop blocking the internet in Egypt. And it's interesting because there is a bill working its way toward the president right now that grants the president of the USA that precise exact authority to shut down websites, to shut down the internet in the USA. We live in interesting times. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. You know, when it comes to flying saucers, UFOs, extraterrestrials, there are loads and loads and loads and loads of videos that you can watch on the internet if you're not in Egypt. DVDs that you can purchase, books you can purchase, people telling their stories. But out of all that sea of information, there are a few that sort of stand out as being very special. And one of those is the account of a man by the name of Woodrow Derenberger, who had an encounter beginning, several encounters, but beginning in 1966, November the 4th, 1966. We're going to talk about that event. We're going to talk about what he experienced, what he saw, what he learned, and we're going to get the privilege of viewing it through his daughter's eyes. Her name is Tanya Bowman, and Tanya Bowman is a fairly remarkable individual in her own right. Tanya is a mother of five. She's a grandmother. She has MS. She is in a wheelchair, and yet active as a volunteer worker, active representing the interests of her state in Washington, D.C., on a committee that her state, West Virginia, has put together. And she's writing a book. She's writing a book about her memories of this period of time in her life growing up with Woodrow Derenberger as her father. Tanya, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're with us this evening.
And thank you for having me on, Kevin.
Tanya, how old were you back in 1966?
I was three.
Okay, so you're 3 years old. Your father, well, I'm getting a little feedback here, and I'm trying not to. Okay, so your father comes home and tells this amazing story. Do you even remember him coming home and telling that story?
No, I don't remember him coming home that night and telling the story. I remember my parents talking about it the next day. It's amazing what a three-year-old can remember.
Well, it is. You know, I remember all the way back to when I was two. I don't remember everything from when I was two, but I remember back certain events back then. But you don't remember him coming home and telling this story?
No, because I believe I was already in bed that night.
Uh-huh. What's your earliest memory of this story?
My parents discussing it the next day. I can remember going downstairs and my dad and my mom talking about it and trying to figure out what to do next.
And was it something that was just at 3 years old, it was had to be something that was just way over your head and you had no idea what it was they were discussing, I guess.
Well, I remember, you know, my dad saying that he got pulled over by a strange craft, as he put it, and speaking telepathically to a gentleman. And, of course, I didn't know what telepathically was, so my dad had to explain it to me. And it was just, I mean, at 3 years old, I really didn't care. But this whole scenario lasted so long, and it was so involved and complicated, more so than what was in Dad's book, that, you know, it's hard not to remember it.
Well, let's recount for our listeners what it is that happened to your dad on the evening of November the 4th, 1966.
Okay, he was driving home from Marietta, Ohio, to our house in Mineral Wells, West Virginia, down 77. It was kind of a rainy night, and he saw something that caught his eye, and he basically, he felt like he should pull over. And when he did is when this craft landed, and I call it a craft out of, I don't know, can't really find a better word for it. And a man, just a man like, you know, like you or any other man, came out of the craft and went to the window of my father's Econoline van and spoke with him through the window without even opening his mouth.
How was this man dressed? How was he dressed?
Dad said, always told me he was dressed in a trench coat that was buttoned almost all the way up to the neck. And that's, and he had on a, like a, just a man's hat. And, I mean, it's not like a lot of people say a little green man, and but Dad had said that that night, since it was dark, so he really couldn't get his features, his facial features, out very well.
What did the man say to him?
Well, first of all, he wanted to make sure that my father realized that he was not going to harm him. He told Dad, which the line always stuck in my head, "Have no fear, I mean you no harm." In fact, I found it funny when they brought out the show V, that they actually used that line in the show. And he basically asked Dad what the lights were in the distance, and Dad told him it was a city, Parkersburg, and he said that they, where he's from, they call that a gathering. And they had, I guess they had quite an extensive conversation. And he was really nice and really polite. And, you know, Dad wasn't afraid.
Now, this guy told your dad, either in that encounter or in a subsequent encounter, his name.
Right. It was in that encounter that he told my dad that his name was Indrid Cold. And my dad introduced himself as Woody Derenberger.
Now, was it in this encounter where this stranger from who knows where, was it in this encounter where he told your dad where he was from, or in a subsequent encounter?
In this encounter, he told Dad that he was from a planet called Lanulus and that he would be back.
He was from Lanulus and that he was what?
He would be back.
He would be back.
He told Dad that Lanulus was in the galaxy of Ganymede.
Okay. Now, I'll tell you something about your dad's encounter that really caught my attention. Because, look, you know as well as I know, as well as all of our audience around the world knows, there are people that claim things that really are just made up. They're just fiction. Maybe they really think it happened and they're having delusions. That happens sometimes too. And then there are some accounts that seem very real. One of the things about your dad's story that to me sounds, it has the ring of being genuine. And that's his description of this craft. because it does not match the description, the popularly held description of UFOs in 1966. It doesn't match with what everybody thought UFOs would be in 1966. And that's the first, I'll point out some more as we go along, but that's the first thing about your dad's encounter that makes a lot of sense to me and makes me say, well, you know, this one may be very real. How did he describe this craft?
He described it as almost like a kerosene lamp on its side.
And what we have is a picture of that on our TV channel. It's an artist's rendition of the van and the man standing beside it. And in front of the van, you have this odd-shaped craft that it does have the shape, basically, of the glass chimney of an old kerosene lamp. Now, nobody in 1966 was talking about flying kerosene lamps. They were talking about flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read this about your dad, when I read this part of his account, that to me stood up and said, this guy didn't make this up. If he was going to make it up, he would have said it was a flying saucer. It landed had three legs that came out, and it landed on those. And, you know, a door opened in the side, and these stairs folded out, and then this little alien came down the steps. That's the way he would have described it if he was making it up based on what people popularly thought about UFOs in 1966. So he gave details that are very, very different from that and make it, to me, sound, it has a ring of truth about it. Now, I know you were 3 years old, but did you notice any change in your dad's personality or in life in general around the house? Did this change things in any way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We had people coming out to our home in Mineral Wells at night and climbing the trees with shotguns to wait for the aliens. And I, you know, it scared the heck out of me being three and, you know, scared my brother. He was only, he would have been 8 years old.
Now, wait a minute. These people were coming onto your property at home?
Yes.
And climbing the trees with shotguns?
Yeah, we had to have the sheriff's department out to our home several times. In fact, we moved quite a few times because people were following us and watching our house. So we moved, probably four or five times. And then finally, the whole incident just came between my parents, and my mother moved us to Cleveland, Ohio for a while.
What kind of work did your dad do?
At that time, he was repairing and selling sewing machines and stereos and things like that.
Did this have any effect on his business?
Not at first. It did after a while. I know in the book, and I have, because I have revised Dad's book, and I was able to get like 100 pages of information from a UFO archive center in Sweden. And I have put in the book eyewitness statements where one of his coworkers was with him at one time when he was stopped.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, the guy was with him, and Dad got a message, and he pulled over again on the highway, and the gentleman that was with him couldn't believe what was going on.
Okay, what was going on? What did he see happen?
A guy just walked up to the door, and my dad was answering his questions without him speaking. I mean, there were all kinds of weird things going on at that time. My mother would go to the store with my brother and I, and my dad would tell her everything that she bought and everywhere she had been.
Okay, let's go back to this incident where a coworker is with him, and he gets a message. And we'll talk about getting the messages in just a moment. But he gets a message. He pulls over. Did the coworker see a craft land or anything like that?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so he pulls over. A guy walks up to, I guess, to the window of the car, right?
Right.
And the guy isn't saying anything, but your dad is speaking and answering questions?
Right.
And the coworker thought what?
Well, from what I have read in reports, the coworker didn't really know what to think. And, I mean, that's honestly basically all I know about that incident.
Okay, let's talk about getting messages. You know, there's a guy by the name of Billy Meyer. And Billy Meyer, are you familiar with Billy Meyer?
No, I'm not.
Billy Meyer has the most famous and most celebrated, by celebrated, I mean like celebrity, long-term, decades-long contact with extraterrestrials of anybody on the planet. He's a farmer, and he has taken film of, you know, back in the days of movie cameras when they actually used film in them instead of video, and he's taken film of these craft landing. I believe he's in Switzerland. And he has written down all of these conversations he's had with extraterrestrials. And there have been people with him when he's had contact with these extraterrestrials. But he gets a message. You know, he can be sitting around the house, maybe having dinner, and he gets a message that he's to go meet them at a certain place. And he gets up, he gets his coat and hat, and gets on his motorbike and heads to that place and has his meeting with these extraterrestrials. Your dad got messages. Did he ever describe how that... Well, we have a break taking over. We come back, we'll pick up right there. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Tanya Bowman. And Tanya, when we went to break, I was just about to ask, you talk about your dad getting the message. Did he ever describe for the family how that happens?
Well, my father and I always talked about this in detail. He just said that he would be eating dinner or... he would be sitting down watching TV, and he would just get this feeling that he needed to go outside. Or he would need to, something would tell him he needed to get in the car and go somewhere to meet someone.
Okay, so it was more just sort of a feeling he would get.
Right.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't really a voice that he heard.
All right, now this visitor, in the very first visit, told him his name was Indrid Cold. And, of course, this is a name that came up in the Mothman prophecies written by John Keel. And a lot of people have either read the book or they have seen the movie. And so Indrid Cold, for a lot of people, they may think, well, it's all just fiction. And yet John Keel is drawing upon your father's story and his experience in putting this character, Indrid Cold, putting this name into the Mothman prophecies. Your dad had subsequent visits, and I guess the question is, was it different extraterrestrials, or was it always Indrid Cold?
No, it was always Indrid Cold. I mean, a couple of times he would bring someone with him, but it was always Indrid that came. In fact, I even when I was young, met Indrid Cold.
Oh, tell us about it.
But instead of speaking to me telepathically, because I was a child and he didn't want to scare me, he actually spoke to me. And it was more of a monotone voice. And he was very nice, because I was outside one time when he came over. He was a very good-looking, taller man, slightly Hispanic-looking, with jet-black hair, and a whispery, like I said, a whispery type of monotone voice.
Do you remember his features? If you were to describe him to a police artist, could you describe him well enough that they could sketch what he looked like?
Not really, because he didn't. I mean, you know, I was three. He was taller than my father. He was, I would say, about 6'7", and I do know that he had very, very dark eyes.
What would you say? Now, you told us that Indrid Cold told your father that he was from a planet called Lanulos.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say if I were to tell you I know someone who says he is from Lanulos, and he is either 6'7 or 6'9"? I cannot remember, and I know him personally.
I've heard about him.
Yeah. He's truly an amazing individual. Now, there came a point where this Indrid Cold took your father on board the ship and took him to his home planet of Lanulos. I'm not for sure, but I think that was in 1969, was it not?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Now, did your dad ever describe what it was like on board that ship?
We didn't really discuss that too much.
Yeah?
Dad would be gone for days at a time and not remember where he had been. And he would come home, and it's almost like they didn't want him to remember where he had been or what he had seen.
Mm-hmm. But he did recount, and at least it is published out there, that he recounted that on Lanulos, the people did not wear clothes. So he remembered that.
Right.
There were
certain things that they did not want him to remember.
Did he remember anything else about the planet?
Not that I recall. Dad's been gone for 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a while since he and I, you know, discussed things. And with my MS, my memory from the last 20 years, just sometimes some of the things just kind of...
Okay, so you're 3 years old when this starts. basically you grew up your entire life right into adulthood with living with all of this information. How long, because your dad had that first incident and then subsequent events, subsequent encounters with Indrid Cold, for how long did he have those encounters with Indrid Cold?
Oh, he had them for years. He had them well into the 70s. Even after my mom, when Earl Neff came from the Cleveland UFO group came to investigate, he brought another gentleman with him who actually my mom had about enough of what was going on, all the people around the house and everything else. So this gentleman was nice enough to take us back to Cleveland with him. And it was shortly after that that my parents divorced and my dad moved to Cleveland also. And I don't believe he had any encounters when he was in Cleveland. I think at that point, they just kind of left him alone.
So as you're growing up and all of this stuff is kind of swirling about you and your family there, were there ever times where you had thoughts that, hey, this is just not true? Did you ever go through that?
Honestly, no, because I honestly believe that my father would never lie to me. And he had all kinds of tests done. I mean, he was examined by a psychiatrist and had tests done, blood tests done, and all sorts of psychological evaluations and everything else, and passed everything.
Uh-huh. So you just never had any doubt in your mind whatsoever about this all being true?
No, none whatsoever.
Now, you met Indrid Cold when you were about 3 years old, is that right?
Right.
Did you ever meet him again?
No.
What was the purpose that he came to your house? Did you ever learn? Did Indrid say, I'd like to meet your family, and so your dad brought him over, or what was the deal?
Yeah, he wanted to meet the family. My mother and my brother wouldn't come out, but I did, because my father told Indrid that I had a box that I called Indrid that was my spaceship. And I guess Indrid got kind of a kick out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to come over and meet me and my mom and my brother. But like I said, my mother and my brother would not come out of the house.
Why? Did they ever say why?
No, my mother really, after we moved to Cleveland, my mother never wanted to talk about it, and my brother just always said, well, this stuff's a bunch of garbage, and, you know, I don't want it in my life anymore. I think he had just had enough of it, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you told us you had people that were coming to your house and climbing the trees with their shotguns. Was, after you kind of got that cleared up, were there other interruptions, other things that happened in your lives where this story was interrupting your lives?
Just every now and then when we were in Cleveland, when we all moved to Cleveland, my father would be on talk shows and things like that. But not too much once we got to Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
It was just mostly when we were living down here and mostly just during the beginning of that time.
Would you say that this became something of an obsession with your father?
An obsession. I think it was just because things were happening that, you know, he was responding.
Mm-hmm.
And since he was out of work because of a lot of this, he was trying to find ways to capitalize on it.
Why would this cause him to be out of work?
I don't remember the whole story. I know it's in the revised version of my book, of Dad's book, but I believe it had interrupted his ability to do his job.
Okay, so he's appearing on talk shows. Would that be television or radio or both?
Both.
Uh-huh. So he's appearing on talk shows. He's telling his story. And, you know, a lot of our audience was not even alive in the 1960s or the 1970s. And so they have absolutely no reference point for what things were like socially and culturally back then. Let me tell you, folks, if you are in that younger crowd, in 1960, really up until about 1965, all through the 50s and up till about 1965, any man who got dressed up, that meant he was wearing either a suit or a sport coat, and it usually was a suit. He was wearing a white shirt. He was wearing a pencil-thin necktie. You remember those, Tonya?
Yes, I do.
Pencil-thin necktie. If he's an executive type, he's probably wearing a hat. And, you know, and very close-trimmed short hair. Socially and culturally, you can say that society pretty much matched that description. By that I mean it was a close-clipped, short-sighted culture and society. And in many, many ways. Now, there were a lot of good things about it. But the reason I set that up that way, Tonya, is to ask you this question. Within the context of that culture and society in the 1960s and 1970s, of course, things were changing radically in the late 60s. But in the context of that culture, in the context of that kind of a society, was your dad subject to ridicule for telling this story?
Some people he was, yes, especially since he appeared on TV here locally, like the day after it happened. In fact, I have.
Well, we'll come back to that question, Tonya. We have a break right now. All right, we'll be back, folks, right after this. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Tonya Bowman. She is the daughter of Woodrow or Woody Derenberger, whose account of encounters with an extraterrestrial by the name of Indrid Cold are really pretty famous. So, Tonya, when we went away for break, you'd just begun to answer a question. The question was your dad ridiculed within the kind of culture we had back then? One would think he would be ridiculed. And you were just about to answer it, and we had to go to break. So let's go back to that. Was he ridiculed?
Yeah, he was to a point because, I mean, back then there were a lot of people who were skeptics. So... yeah, he was to a point, especially when people would come out to our farmhouse in Mineral Wells and not see anything.
Mm-hmm. What about you and your brother? Were you ridiculed?
My brother was. I was not in school yet, so it really didn't affect me too much.
How did he handle that?
I was a little bit later in life when people would... hear my last name.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're like, well, you know, your dad's full of malarkey and everything. And it just, you know, I just said, well, believe what you want to believe.
Well, yeah, that's true. But, you know, there are things about me that you don't know, and that our audience does know because they listen to me every night, and some of them have been with me since I started the show 10 years ago. And one of those things is that I've lived all over the world. And I use this example a lot. If I say to you, do you know what a bat is? You know, the little furry animal that flies?
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody in the world would say, yeah, I know what a bat is. And if I say, what if I were to tell you that I saw a bat with a wingspan of 6 feet? 6 foot wingspan on this bat. Almost everybody in the world would say, that's malarkey. That's nonsense. And yet, I tell you, they exist, and I've eaten them. They do exist in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, that area, they exist. It's called a fox bat. And they are big, really big. And the same thing, if I were to say, heard somebody in my house one night yelling, F you. And I got up and started looking. I couldn't find anybody in the house, but I found a lizard that was 2.5 feet long stuck to my ceiling screaming, F you. They would say, that's malarkey. And yet I tell you, they exist. In Southeast Asia, they exist. And they are referred to as the F.U. lizard. And it sounds like a human screaming it. And they do it at night, wake you up. And my point in telling those two examples is, and that's just two. I've got probably 100 examples of things like that. But people, unfortunately, tend to think that the world is just like where their feet are standing. If they haven't seen it, if they haven't experienced it, it isn't real. That's
right.
The way people tend to think. And the fact is, we haven't seen or personally experienced almost everything there is to see and experience. We just get a tiny little slice of it in our lives, our little piece of personal experience. It's very tiny. It's microscopic. And unfortunately, there are intellectual mudsuckers who think that somehow if they haven't seen it, if they haven't experienced it, it's not real. That was particularly in the 60s. That was pretty much the case. Everybody had almost a myopic. We were subjected to some ridicule later in life. How old were you?
Probably about 12 or 13.
How did that strike you?
It didn't really affect me. I just knew that my father was telling the truth. And now, I wish I had the evidence then that I have now, because in the stuff that I got from Sweden are other eyewitness accounts of this.
Mm-hmm.
Other eyewitness reports that had been given to the authorities of people who saw my father pulled over that night and saw what was going on.
So there were witnesses that saw the UFO?
Yes. They didn't come forward right away, but mm-hmm. they did eventually come forward and give the authorities, you know, their eyewitness account.
Are you aware of any changes in your father's worldview as a result of all of this?
Not really. It didn't really change who he was or what he thought.
Mm-hmm. How did he react to the ridicule?
He just, I think that's where I get it. He just kind of brushed it off. You know, it didn't really affect him. It more affected my mother and my brother than mm-hmm. it did my father and I.
Did he ever speculate out loud as to why Indrid Cold decided to contact him? Why him?
I don't know. He thought maybe it was because he was, I mean, there was hardly anybody else on the road that night. And he was just an ordinary person. So, and that's the type of person Indrid wanted to appear to first. Was just an ordinary working family man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a deacon in his church, and Indrid just figured that he would be the perfect person to appear to.
Did your dad get any kind of heavy messages, weighty messages from Indrid Cold?
Not really.
So all of their meetings were just sort of social meetings?
Right.
What would they talk about?
Well, Dad never went into real detail. They would talk about, you know, their families and just normal conversation like one man would have with another.
Okay, so did Indrid describe his family?
Yes, he had a wife named Kimmy, and he had two children, like a boy and a girl, just like my father did. And he said that his job on Lake Yost, oh, I'm sorry, that's my St. Bernard. He said he was a searcher. He was like a scout.
A scout.
But, he said the one big difference between people on Earth and people on Lanulus is that people on Lanulus live a lot longer. They live to be about 125 to 150 years old in our years. They don't really count years on Lanulus. And they keep their, you know, they look younger longer. So I figure at this point, Indrid would be probably about 80 years old because he told Dad at that time that he was about 30.
So he told your dad he's about 30, but you think he was about 80?
No, I said no. If Indrid is still alive, and I honestly believe that he is, he would be about 80.
Ah, I understand. And what would you suspect he would look like? Pretty much like he did when he was 30?
Well, he'd probably... No, I mean, he'd probably... They keep a younger appearance, but I don't think they keep their same appearance. I think Indrid would probably look like he was about 50. They just don't... They age, but they don't age as fast as we do.
So he's a searcher or a scout for what?
He didn't really say.
Uh-huh.
He never really explained that to Dad. Dad had asked him that, you know, what he was searching for, scouting for, and he just said, I can't give you that information.
Mm-hmm. Did your dad ever get the sense that Indrid was somehow military? Well, we have to take a break. We'll be back. And we will answer and be glad to hear you, or you can send us a flash message. How about that? 623-444-5889. Let me remind folks again, because we have a lot of new folks listening, By the way, ladies and gentlemen, we hit a new high on our affiliate station in Los Angeles last night. Last night, we hit 1.8 million. Caller, you want to hang on through the break? All right, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Tanya Bowman. Tanya, we have a caller online, so let's go straight to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from bye-bye. Okay, didn't hang on. 623-444-5889. That's the number to call. 888-223-4599. That's the toll-free number. Tanya, you said that the main reason that you're writing the book is because it did not, the original book that your dad wrote did not have your perspective of what you were thinking about all of this, and then some additional information and documentation. So, I guess really what we have with the new book is your dad's book with your additional information about how it was impacting you, how you saw it, how you experienced it, and then some additional documentation. Is that correct?
Dad's book that I revised doesn't really have any perspective of mine. Basically, what it's got is it's got the additional documentation of the eyewitness reports and the psychologist report and things like that.
All right. Okay, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Kit from Payson, Arizona.
Okay, Kit. Is this Kit McGuire?
Oh, you got that right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kit McGuire is an on-air presenter at the affiliate in Los Angeles that carries our show. What's on your mind, Kit?
Well, I've been listening to your show, Kevin, and I couldn't help but call and let Tanya know that what she's experienced, what she's saying and talking about is just phenomenal. I guess my question is for not only Tanya, but you, Kevin, and you know I'm into this just as much as you and everybody else. I often have to wonder how, you know, does anybody have any idea how many people are visiting people here on Earth? I mean, you know, it's always been my dream for somebody to visit me.
Well, what do you think, Tanya? How many of us Earthlings are being visited by these ETs?
It's really hard to say. I think a lot of people are, and they're not saying anything about it because they're afraid of being ridiculed and laughed at. I mean, I myself would be shouting it from the rooftop. I know there is one gentleman in Massachusetts who's constantly writing me hoping to have a visit by Indrid or someone. I guess he corresponded with my father years ago, and he found me online, and now he's corresponding with me. But I think there are a lot of people that are being visited out there through some form, and they're just afraid to say anything.
Yeah, I personally think it's a blessing beyond all reason and imagination, and you're so fortunate, you're so lucky and blessed. you go for it, girl, and shout from the rooftops. Let everybody know.
Oh, I'm trying. I'm trying to, you know, keep it alive, and I've got friends who are trying to keep it alive. I have one gentleman who in the last couple of years I've become friends with, who it hasn't been released yet, but he just made a movie about the Mothman, and he put part of my father's story in the movie, and it was nice because he sent me what he was going to put in the movie about my dad and let me, you know, say okay or no, this is wrong.
All right, Kit, thank you for the call, man. Good to hear from you. I caught part of your show the other day, and I got to say, you got those golden pipes, man. You sound good on the radio.
And I thank you so much, Kevin. You and your show just rock, and we do our best here to get the word out. Keep up the good work, Kevin. We'll talk to you later. Thank you so much, Tanya.
Oh, thanks for calling.
Now, folks, I know Kit, and he is one of the on-air presenters at the affiliate out in Los Angeles. But I promise you, that was not a set-up deal. We didn't plan together and get him to call in. All right, promise you, that was all on his own. Pardon me. Now, in answer to his question, how many people are being visited, percentage-wise, I think it would be a small number. Look, we've got almost 7 billion people on the planet. And unless you had at least, say, 25% of that number of extraterrestrials, there's no way they could get around to visiting everybody. Now, out there in the universe, there are probably a great many more than 25% of that number. There are probably ultra billions of intelligent extraterrestrial civilizations scattered out through the universe. But I'm talking about right here on Earth. You'd have to have a number of, say, 25% or so, or even, say, 10% of the population of Earth. You take 10%, and that number of extraterrestrials is about what you'd have to get everyone visited, because there's a whole bunch of us. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Tanya. It's Heidi from Manitoba calling.
Hello, Heidi.
Hi. I just had a couple of questions here. Tanya, I'd like to ask you, did your dad ever talk about ETs participating in the evacuation of humanity in the future? Did he ever talk about that? And also, what are your thoughts on this topic?
No, actually, he never really did. We never really discussed that. Our discussions were mostly just kind of what happened to him and what happened with my parents' marriage because of what he had gone through. And no, I don't really have any... I don't think that I can't see them trying to, you know, ruin our civilization.
Mhm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call, Heidi. You know, I had a call here to the show one night, Tanya, where the caller, and I can't even remember now whether it was a man or a woman that called in, so I certainly can't remember the name, but I'm an old guy and I forget things, so that's okay. But we had a caller that in the course of our conversation brought up Indrid Cold and wondered if, you know, there was any more information on Indrid Cold. Because he had heard, or she had heard about Indrid Cold and the Mothman prophecies, did some research to see who is Indrid Cold, ran across your dad's story, And, you know, I just think it has to be so cool that you met Indrid Cold face to face. That's just got to be the coolest thing on the planet.
Well, like I said, he knew that, you know, I was a very curious child and not afraid of anything. In fact, Indrid had a nickname for me. He called me Fearless Little One, because I wasn't afraid.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take this call, and then I have a question about that. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Caller, are you with us?
Kevin?
Yeah, are you listening to the radio or are you listening to your telephone?
Kevin, I can hardly hear you. This is Tim from New York.
We can hear you, and that's the point. Okay? So your first name again?
I wish I had known that Tanya was going to be on there tonight, because I have the original broadcast on the West Virginia radio station the night, or maybe it was the next day, after Woody's encounter on the highway there.
Uh-huh.
And it's a pretty good quality. And, you know, I knew Woody fairly well. He had visited me in New York and spoke for our UFO group. And I even did a couple of radio shows with him. And there were quite a number of people who called, you know, on the air during the interviews to tell of their sightings, and also some people who had also claimed to have met the same being, you know, this Indrid Cold. And I always felt that, you know, Woody was pretty sincere in his presentation of his experiences, especially, of course, the initial one. And I've heard them all. So, you know, that's something to be said.
So I see after you started talking, I realized from your voice who you are. Tanya, this is Tim Beckley. Timothy Beckley. He's written a whole bunch of books and published a whole bunch of magazines about UFOs.
Well, in fact, you know, over the years, I wrote a couple of articles on Woody's experiences, and I think they are in a couple of my books. Can't remember exactly which, you know, but we did have quite a bit of follow-up testimony on his you know, sightings. In fact, I do believe that I also spoke to people who lived in the neighborhood there in West Virginia, who had sightings near the house where you lived or where he lived at the time.
Right. Yeah. There were a lot of people around there that knew what was going on.
Tanya, have you been speaking out about this much, or is this kind of recent that you've begun to speak out about it?
I haven't really been speaking out about it much. I've had a bunch of other things going on. I've had the revised book done for a little over a year, and I've had a few people buy it. You know, they were curious, and they couldn't find the original book except for like $400 on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's very strange about the original book. It's almost as if the publisher or someone tried to censor that volume, because as many shows as Woody was on, and he was on the, you know, the Long John show here in New York, of course, and that had a tremendous audience, especially for the, you know, those days, Kevin. And there were we even sold some of the copies of the books at the Occult Center. We couldn't get them. It was like the publisher or somebody was trying to, you know, to censor the story. So I think there's, you know, enough interest in it now that people would want to go back and read the experience. And if you want a copy of that original radio broadcast with Woody, I'd be more than happy to share it with you, you know, and could maybe even include it with the book or something. Anyway, I just wanted to add my two cents on that, Kevin, and keep up the good work. You always have a great show, and this one in particular really grabbed me tonight.
All right. Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, well, $400 for a copy of the original book, huh?
Yeah, Yeah, that's what I had found it for on eBay.
All right, we'll step away for a break, and when we come back, we'll be on Final Approach. Get your fingers ready to do the dialing. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're on Final Approach. That means we don't have but just a few minutes left in tonight's show. My guest this evening, Tanya Bowman. And Tanya, we have a flash message from Australia. One of our listeners over there, Lawrence, who says he's a native of New York, but he is in Australia at the moment. And he says, what part of your dad's encounters stand out the most to you?
Probably where he talks about and told us about the initial encounter. I thought it was... It's always really stuck in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we had people, you know, all over the house all the time.
Now, your dad, the next day after this initial encounter, your dad went and reported this to the police and the news, right?
Well, it was actually reported to the police that evening.
Uh-huh.
It was reported to the news the next day. The next day is when he went on the air and with Glenn Wilson here at WTAP and did an interview.
How did the police respond to this initial report?
Well, from what Dad and Mom said, they kind of thought Dad was a little nuts. And they took his report, but they didn't really take him very seriously until some other people came forward after Dad's interview.
I had a guest on this show that told me about seeing a very large UFO over his ranch. And this happened on several nights, each night. And then, I don't know, like the third or fourth night, he called the sheriff's office and asked them to send a deputy out, which they did. The deputy arrived, and of course, as he was arriving, he could see the UFO. He gets out of his car, and this man that was a guest on my show pointed up and he said, "That's what I want to report." And the deputy said, "I see what you see. And now I don't see it, and I'm not going to write a report on it." And he got in his car and drove away. Actually, I believe that report is true. I believe it's true because I lived in that county and I know that sheriff's office. And I believe that's probably how they responded to it. I don't have any doubt in my mind about that. Unfortunately, there are a lot of police that have the mental mudsucker frame of reference. Not all of them, but unfortunately there are some. If you were to see something like your dad saw in that initial encounter, if you had an experience, something like that, would you call the police, knowing what you know now? Would you call the police to report it?
I probably would. Not that they would believe me. In fact, when my daughter had her sighting,
uh-huh.
I initially called a friend of mine who leads a paranormal group here, and I told her to call me if any of her group calls them and says that they saw something. I didn't call the police at that time because my daughter was only like 13 years old, and I didn't want to submit her to that. But if I had a sighting myself, yeah, I would probably call the police and report it.
I'm curious as to why. Why would you call the police?
Just, I don't know, just to let them know that something was going on and to see if anybody else had reported it.
You know, I am, well, I'm no longer working as a cop, but I've been a cop all my life. And even though we'll say I'm a cop, even though I'm a cop, I don't think I'd call the cops. Not because I'm afraid of them, but because, number one, there's nothing they can do about it. And number two, they'd probably send some dummy that would have that nose-in-the-air attitude that there's something wrong with me. And, you know, the cops are a reflection. They're just a slice out of all of society. There's some of them that are very open-minded and some of them that are very myopic. And some of them, I think, don't even have one eye open. And it'd just be my luck they'd send me some dummy. And, you know, he would think I'm nuts. And since I know there's not, even if you send me an open-minded one that says, okay, let's do the report. Even that guy, there's nothing he can do about it. So, I'm not sure I'd call them. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm just kind of the frame of mind that, you know, I don't need the government to pat me on the head and say, yep, you saw what you saw. I know what I saw.
The more the government stays out of it, the better.
Well, you know, Tanya, that's true of almost everything.
Yeah, I really believe that the government knows more about this stuff like Roswell and things than they're telling us.
Yeah, I think so. And in fact, they probably know Indrid Cold. They probably know all the details about your dad's encounter. I don't know. I don't want to make it sound like I distrust the police just because they're police. It's not distrust. It's I know. I mean, I know them from the inside out, and they're just like the rest of the population. And I just don't have any confidence. It's not distrust. I just don't have any confidence that calling them would do anything for us. Other than this, it does do one thing that's positive. It officially documents that you're saying on this date, at this time, I saw this. So it does officially document it. Other than that, I'm not really sure of what value the police would be. I don't know. With UFOs, I just consider police to be irrelevant. You know?
Right. I mean, my first call would probably be to one of the UFO investigative organizations.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I would rather have someone who is a UFO investigator on the case right away. And, you know, I think I'd report it to them. If you had all of this growing up with this and living with it all these years, if you had any of it to do over, what would you do differently?
I honestly don't know that I would do anything differently. I mean, you know, my life was good. It was fine. I loved my father with all my heart. And it just, I don't think I would really do anything differently.
Do you think he would?
No, I don't think so. I know, you know, during the last years of my father's life, he really, at that point, didn't want to talk about it anymore. But I think that's because he had talked about it for so long.
Well, I wish we had longer to talk about it. Tanya, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being here with us on the Kevin Smith Show this evening. People all around the world have heard your dad's story. If you will, stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's going to be a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Because you have a right to know. Until next time, so long, everybody.